I had to sell my house to do it because I couldn't afford my house and I was in debt and it was getting worse, but I was so determined. And over the last 10 years, the debt's gone. We live in paradise. I've got time, which is the most precious resource because I earn really good money doing the work that I do. I'm lucky enough that my bread and butter work, which is the leadership stuff and the culture stuff, comes to me. I don't have to go looking for it because I've got a really good reputation and I earn really, really good money. The kids have got a great life. We love where we live. I get to travel the world running retreats in the Himalaya and in Bali, and that's awesome. I've just signed a book deal in the States, like I mentioned to you before, and that's fucking cool. And there's the TEDx talk and there's the online programs that I've designed, and I'm excited about the future. There's more to come, and there's still plenty of time to surf and go away on holidays and camp and hike and trek and play my guitar. And so I'm very lucky, man. I feel very, very lucky.
Quickly though, before this episode starts, I've got a 10-second favor that I'd like to ask you. The majority of people watching this podcast haven't yet hit the follow button. I can't tell you how much it helps. The show gets bigger, which means we can increase our production and also allows us to bring in some of the best guests that you want to see while allowing us to continue to do the thing that we love. Thank you so much for your time. Jem, welcome to the podcast.
Adam, thanks for having me on, man. It feels like we've been getting this to this point in time for a little while now, which is lovely. And so, yeah, it's great to be finally having a chat with you.
Of course, of course. Life is chaotic and sometimes things have to change and it's okay to let those things change. The one thing that I do, however, is I am unrelentingly persistent.
Well, we've got that in common, dude. We have so got that in common. One of my values is flexibility. Not
physical,
not necessarily physical flexibility, mental flexibility. And I just find it a really functional thing to focus on practicing because life's easier when you're flexible. And also I think if you hold on too tightly to, you know, a particular design or a belief or an idea or a course, you know, if you hold on too tightly to it, then amidst the chaos of the unpredictable world, you tend to be, you know, can I swear on this podcast, by the way?
Do whatever the fuck you want.
Okay, cool. You tend to be pushing shit uphill, right? And that takes a lot of energy and it's not the best way to achieve anything. So flexibility, I think, is a high functioning thing to practice and be aware of to that end. And also tenacity, I call it tenacity, persistence. If I think something's worthwhile making happen, then yeah, I'm a bit like a dog with a bone, you know, they don't let go of it. Let's make this happen, you know.
Get it done. I've got this book idea called Politely Persistent. I've like,
yeah,
it's floating around in my head. So, you know, if you write it before me, go ahead. But if you
no,
don't,
there's a whole bunch of other books I have to write before that. Hey, I've just signed a publishing deal. Oh, you know, I get to write. That's right. No, yes, my contract. I just signed my first ever publishing deal, which I'm pretty excited about. With a publisher in the States. Shout out Mango Publishing. I love you guys already just because you said yes to me.
It's the first time.
yeah. Well, it's my first proper publishing deal. I engaged a publisher here in Australia to publish the book a couple of years ago, but that was a hybrid situation where I just paid them to do everything and they just did it. Whereas this is a publishing deal where I'm not paying them. They're doing everything and they'll get their commission off the sales, which is nice.
They give you an advance?
Oh, no. Damn, no. But if I had have had an advance, like the good old days, then I would have had to have written X amount of books because it's all, contractual and we're giving you this money, but you have to do this.
Would that have been a good or a bad thing for your work?
Well, look, I was just about to say the deal I've got is they've got 3 years first right of refusal. So anything I write, they get to look at it first and decide if they want to publish it. But I'm not contracted to have to write any number of particular books. We're in conversations around the series of books that I am going to write. But like you said, it's not because I have to, it's because I want to, which is a good distinction.
I love it. Well, leading into maybe what you're writing about, if you could give us an elevator pitch of who you are, what you do, and how you're contributing to world, what would that sound like?
Well, there's two different elevator pitches, right? There's an elevator pitch if I'm trying to sell something to someone and what I do, and then I go, well, I'm a leadership coach and I help leaders communicate more effectively with their teams to build healthier workplace cultures, right? And my clients are across government departments and in the private sector and the not-for-profit sector, blah, blah, blah. So that's the professional what do I do for money pitch kind of thing. But if I met someone in an elevator and they were genuinely curious, as in, who are you, man? Hi, nice to meet you. Who are you? Then I'd kind of come at it from a different direction and say, you know, I'm someone who aspires every day to try my best and live by my values, which is kindness and generosity and presence, open-mindedness, curiosity, love and contribution. So this is who I try to be as a person. I'm madly in love with
flexibility and tenacity.
Flexibility, thank you. Open-mindedness. Madly in love with my beautiful, gorgeous partner and our four teenagers. We're a blended family. We live down the coast. I love to surf, not very well, but I do love it. I love hiking in the outdoors. I'm really passionate about communication, right? Hence the book and the TED Talk and the series, but super, super passionate about communication because our ability to communicate underpins our ability to be effective in everything that we do, everything that we do, right? I mean, you can't even have a genius idea and then manifest that into reality or some sense of value to anyone else without the ability to communicate the idea, right? I mean, Einstein could have had these amazing ideas around theory of relativity, but if he couldn't communicate it, it wouldn't have meant anything to anyone. And then also in all of our relationships and primarily our relationship with ourself, right, which I think is the place to start in terms of your quality of life and the quality of your ability to hopefully contribute to the lives of others in some way, shape or form. So it starts with the communication with self and then with others, you know, and then also, so you've got me on my rave about communication, but also from a global humanitarian perspective, we've got some pretty big problems that we've created. Right? Pretty big problems that we've created. And to be honest, Adam, I don't actually know whether we're going to get through the next 20 to 50 years. I honestly don't know.
I think we will be okay. I think we'll be okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, and that's nice. And I live as an optimist as well. But if I had to put money on it, I don't know, right? Because, and we'll go into that in a sec. But the big problems that we need to really come together on is the only way we're going to solve them is by bridging these divides of difference, right? Whether it's political difference or religious difference or philosophical or spiritual difference or geographical difference or money inequality difference, the only way we're going to solve these bigger problems is by bridging these divides of difference. And the only way to do that is through more conscious communication and harnessing the power of diversity. Right. If you think about it, if you have a big problem and you pop it on a table and you've got a group of people around the table collectively trying to solve that problem, but all the people sitting around the table all come from a very, very similar demographic, right? Just say they're all middle-class white males sitting around this thing and they all grew up in Australia. You're going to have a very narrow bandwidth of creative, alternative, solution-solving possibilities. Very narrow bandwidth. To solve these bigger problems, we need diversity. We need people coming from places that each other had no conception that the other person was going to come up with that idea. And we go, what? How did you even think of that? And what is that like? And let me be open-minded to your way of seeing things because it's so different to mine. So rather than getting defensive and shutting each other down and becoming more and more polarized and canceling each other on social media and going to war with each other because we've got different opinions, we need to harness that shit, you know. So anyway, I'm pretty passionate about communication.
Mm-hmm. And there's a few things I wanted to dig into there. You mentioned we could talk about the diversity stuff first. Like, what is it about the diversity itself that is the value driver for the decision making?
Just that broader bandwidth of ways of seeing things. Truly creative solutions are more likely to come from the bigger pool of ideas and also from not necessarily from the experts always. I mean, the experts add value to a conversation, obviously, because they've dedicated their lives to understanding a particular thing, right? So they bring a lot of value to a conversation. But also the person who doesn't know what they're talking about, who might just have a crazy idea, one out of 100 times that crazy idea might have something in it. You might go, holy shit, we never thought of that. Let's look into that. How could that possibly add to this conversation? You know, so you should be asking the post person, the person who's delivering the mail. Ask them, how do you reckon I could get this rocket over there? I don't know. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot written about this by Dr. Peter Diamandis in his book, Get Abundance. He's a pretty brilliant man, but he's big on this. Don't always ask an expert. We need to be asking everyone.
It's funny you say that because I was listening to a podcast called Founders, which I'm absolutely in love with at the moment. It's basically this guy that reads a lot of books about founders and you know, a lot of autobiographies, and then he distills the information into a podcast. And a number of them, of these founders, say don't go anywhere near experts because you're not going to get the decisions you want from the experts.
Well, especially if you want innovation, because experts, the definition of being an expert is that you know everything there is to know about that topic. So if you think that you know everything about it, then you're not open to new ideas because you're the expert and you know everything. So if you want innovation, if you want truly genius, innovative ideas, perhaps don't ask an expert.
Yeah, it's a fine line to be in then if you've built your business model on being an expert in something.
Well, you can be someone who's passionate about something and has dedicated a lot of time to a particular thing and practice open-mindedness as well. You can be both.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people get fixed the more they know about a topic, the deeper they go, the more fixed they get in their opinions of that topic?
I think that's the natural tendency for human beings. You know, that's where confirmation bias comes from, which is very natural for us to do. You know, we get very defensive about our ideas because we identify with our ideas. So especially our political and ideological, the more important ideas that we have, the beliefs we have around the way we think things should be, they actually start to form, and very literally in our brains, the same areas of the brain light up when we talk about our sense of identity of who I am, as when we talk about our political or ideological beliefs. Same part of the brain lights up. So we very literally identify with our beliefs, and our ego, which is our sense of identity, is super, super defensive, because if the ego feels challenged, that threat to the ego is akin to real, real life and death, even though it's not actually. I mean, you get super defensive over an idea, but your ego defends it like it's life and death. You know, and that's why we saw people through the pandemic completely falling out with someone who they were friends with, because one was pro-vax and one was anti-vax. And then they got to the point where they're like, fuck you, I'm not talking to you ever again. We are not friends
anymore. I had that experience. Someone did that to me and really? It blew me away. I couldn't believe it. A friend of mine that I've had for years said, we can't, I don't think I can be friends with you if you don't get vaccinated. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Now, the reason they said that.
What?
Yeah. The reason they said that is because, and they didn't know this, but what was going on for them psychologically was that they felt, their ego felt that their sense of identity, who they were, as in I'm a pro-vaxxer, was their sense of identity was in threat. That's why they got so defensive over it. And it's like life and death. So to protect themselves, they're like, I can't be friends with you anymore, because what they were actually protecting or defending was their idea that we should be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Crazy. Yeah, and this happens all wild. Over the place. You know?
That was a very interesting, I haven't really spoken much about the COVID stuff, but that was a very interesting, I think we've had enough time pass now where we don't get canceled for talking about it, but not enough time,
at this thing that we should worry about being canceled. I'm like, I'm so over it. Do you know what I mean? I think it's just so important that if your intention is good, you know, and it's a shame because this is not happening out there in the world of cancellation. And, you know, I'm not on Twitter, so I can't get cancelled, I think, because I'm not on Twitter. I don't know. But, you know, it's such a shame that people have forgotten to take into the equation of judgment. What was that person's intention? What were they, what were underneath the words they maybe clumsily used. What was their intention? What were they trying to do in that moment? You know, and we've forgotten that. It's like you say one wrong word and all of a sudden you're going to get cancelled for being clumsy with a word, even if you're a good person with a good heart and you are all the right things. So I just think, it just drives me nuts.
I think there's a lot of pushback now. There is definitely a lot of pushback in this narrative from most people. Most people are tired of this approach to like communication and interacting with one another to the point where you're starting to see it. Attempts to cancel people are just failing because people don't really care as much anymore.
Yeah.
So I think it will balance.
Mm. I was just going to say, like, I remember friends, people that I knew, even got sucked into this, and it wasn't any their fault, but they got sucked into this when this when the thing came out about Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. I remember getting posts to me, messages to me, and this saying, if you don't start posting Black Lives Matter, that means that through being complicit and silent, you're racist. And I was like, hang on, that's fucking ridiculous because I'm refusing to post something. It's not because of something I posted. It's because I choose not to post. I don't post anything political. I never post anything political. I just don't want to get into the conversation on social media. It's just not where I want to spend my time. I'll sit down with my friends and have deep conversations about stuff that matters, but I just don't – it's my choice not to post political stuff. Now, don't try and tell me that I'm racist just because I don't want to post political stuff. You don't – what the fuck are you talking about? Anyway, so, you know, that's how I feel about it. Maybe I'm going to get cancelled now.
You might, and that's okay. you're fine. I mean, I don't have an audience to cancel me yet, so it's...
I know. But you know what?
I'm free.
I know, we're free. We're free now, Adam, but you know what? This cancel culture, 20 years from now, they'll go digging back. If someone wants to cancel us, they will dig all the way back to this podcast 20 years from now and they'll pull it out. And if the climate is the same then, which it won't be because everything changes, but over the last few years, this is how crazy it is. They will go back and dig something up that someone said 15 years ago and cancel them because of that. I'm like, that is a witch hunt. It's fucking stupid. What happens to redemption? What happens to growth and evolution? Holy shit, when I was 20 years old, I said things I wouldn't say now. But that's just growing up.
So
what are you going to do? Go back to when I was a teenager and say some stupid thing, find some stupid thing I said when I was a teenager and then cancel me because of it? That's just so dumb.
I agree. I think it's losing its touch.
Yeah, it's becoming ridiculous.
Tying into the COVID thing, tying into the vaccination thing and tying into how that actually played out, I think a lot of people that have followed the, all right, well, this is seems like the right thing to do are going, hold on a second. So it's beginning to backfire. Like people aren't stupid.
Yeah.
They're trusting of authority, but they're not stupid.
Less and less trusting now.
Yeah, less and less trusting. And that's the thing. Only so many chances do authorities have to fuck it up before people go, no, you know what, I'm good. There's a really interesting thing that I noticed while we're on this topic, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it's just something I noticed. The countries that had the most intense lockdown periods, which from what I've gathered from information that's come out, a lot of like health experts have come out saying they were terrible ideas.
Yeah.
So it's not me. I'm just standing. However, the countries that had the most intense lockdown periods were New Zealand, Australia, Canada.
Right.
What do they all have in common?
All part of the Commonwealth? Or were?
Exactly. They're all Commonwealth countries that were given to the people that are now in control of them by a country or an empire that got them by force.
Yeah.
So the people in those countries haven't had to fight for shit.
Yeah.
Haven't had to fight for anything.
No.
Handed on a silver platter. So when the moment came, when push came to shove,
yeah,
we all just rolled over and we're like, yeah, all right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, a lot of the other, the French, the Americans, all of these countries that are like distrustful of the central government, a lot of them fought back.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that makes sense.
I think it only takes one though. It only takes one situation like this for a countries like this to go, nah, not again. You know, we just were not used to it. Yeah. We just weren't used to it because we've had it so well. We've had it so good for so long.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my random thought on and why that might have played out. And I'm sure that there's holes in that logic, but.
Oh, man. But it's not just one thing. It's not just one thing that makes up any given situation. It's always more complex than meets the eye. And, you know, what you just shared about the socio-cultural psychology of nations that were that became the way they are because of the past. And in this case, you know, talking about England and going out and killing natives and stealing land and then calling it and then giving it to the convicts and the gold rush people and going, there you go, there's the lucky country. And us not having to fight for it, but having to live with the shame of the genocides that went on and, you know, all of it. There's a massive, massive complex mix that creates a culture, right? And it's the same with the situation in the Middle East, the whole thing. It's not just as simple as Israel and Gaza fighting each other. It's not. It's way more complex than that. And to just come in and say there's just this one narrative going on and choose a side is just a dumb thing to do. You know, there's way much more going on than that. And so every little bit adds into the conversation, doesn't it? And it's the same with us as a species. You know, we've become so incredibly complex that we're to some degree neurotic and highly anxious. To some degree. We're just, you know, we flip out over shit. We spend most of our lives in a fight or flight state, the sympathetic nervous system activated, right? Which is what you really should only need when a lion's chasing after you. Or when your kid's running out onto a main road to get their basketball and there's traffic, right? That's when it should switch on and you quickly bolt out there and grab the kid and save their life. That's when the sympathetic nervous system needs to be activated, right? But we have it on, when I say we, I'm generalizing us humans. We have it on so much more than necessary. Like you imagine there's someone working in an office, sitting at their desk and they're working in the corporate world in a suit and tie and the CEO walks in and they're like, oh shit, fuck, it's the CEO, right? And they sit up in their chair and they, you know, they're switched on like fly or fight, like, oh shit, I haven't done anything wrong. Or people driving down the road and they see a cop car. Oh, fuck, it's the cops, right? So it switches on unnecessarily. The CEO is not going to come over and eat you. And then it stays switched on for the rest of the day. You're walking around, you know, drinking our coffee and heightened and going, oh, fuck, I'm stressed and, you know, too much work on and blah, blah, blah. And then we get home and we drink half a bottle or a bottle of wine to turn it all off and then we fall over into bed. And then we wake up the next day and switch it all back on and do it all over again. We're so neurotic.
What do you think the solution is to tone down the neurosis?
Neurosis. Well, one of them, which has been super helpful for me since creating a regular and dedicated practice, is mindfulness meditation. A daily practice. Well, and if you don't currently have a mindfulness meditation practice, don't kind of turn around.
Then we will shame you into doing it.
yeah. But certainly don't try and jump around and say, right, I'm going to meditate every day, because you won't, and then you'll beat yourself up for it, and that'll lead to more kind of, you know, self-loathing flagellation psychology. No, if you don't have a meditation practice and you're curious, just start with 5 minutes twice a week or something. I don't know. But for me, it's 20 minutes every morning, and it's been really remarkable you're just training your mind and your brain really to come to a resting state of equanimity, which is not reacting to things as much, just staying a bit more calm and centered. And it's beautiful. I love it.
So how does equanimity curb neuroticism? Neurosis. Is neuroticism a word? Look
that up. Let's make it a word. Neuroticism.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Nice.
It's a word. Okay.
Yeah, relief. You're going to read out the definition for me because I'm not exactly sure what it means.
You want me to read out the definition?
Yeah.
Let's have a look. A trait disposed to experience of negative effects, including anger, anxiety, self-consciousness, irritability, emotional instability, and depression.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So how does mindfulness meditation help with this? What you're doing when you are practicing mindfulness, and it's a practice, and it's not easy because we've all got very busy brains, but what you're doing is you are practicing being in a place of observation with no attachment or judgment or reaction to what you're observing. Anything that shows up in your conscious awareness, so anything that you can hear or see or smell or taste, any sensations, any physical sensations, like the feeling of the points of contact with the chair that you're sitting in, you can notice that, right? If you take your attention to it, you can notice it. You can even notice your thoughts. You can simply observe your thoughts, right? So anything that you can notice in your conscious awareness can be an object of your observation. It doesn't matter what you're observing, you're simply observing it. And the idea is that as you practice observing anything without being attached to it or identified with it or carried away with it, then you are less immersed in the experience itself, and it becomes just a point of curiosity. So, for example, if I'm feeling anxiety, right? So I'm feeling anxious about something. Say I've got a big keynote coming up and I'm a bit anxious about, oh my God, this is a really important keynote. So I'm feeling anxiety about that. The practice of mindfulness in that moment would be to sit and close my eyes and simply observe what I can notice. So am I noticing a sensation in my tummy, or am I noticing a tightness in my chest? Am I noticing perhaps a slight temperature increase in my head, or am I noticing thoughts that are looping on something? Whatever it is, I'm simply noticing it. I'm not trying to change it. I'm not trying to get rid of it. I'm not trying to do anything with it. I'm just noticing it. And what happens as we practice this over time, it gets easier to come back to that place of observation and be less affected. So when you're less affected by something, this is equanimity. You know, you're simply in the moment and present. And it's remarkable what happens, because whatever you're experiencing tends to dissipate and change and move much quicker. So you can go from a state of being consumed by anger, say something's happened and you're really, really angry, and we identify with the anger because we say, I am angry, as in that's who I am right now. We don't say I'm experiencing anger. We say, I'm angry, right? So that's what I am right now, and it's very hard to let go of it when I'm identified with it. But to sit down, close your eyes and breathe, slow your breathing down, and just notice the state that you're in. It dissipates. And before you know it, you're like, oh, wow, I'm feeling completely calm again. And that, I think that can be a bit of a superpower, you know, because then you're the driver of your own physiological bus. You're not the victim. It's not like, well, fuck, I'm feeling this right now. Or, oh, my God, I'm feeling this right now. Or, right now, no, that's a victim. I'm the passenger on this bus that is this body. This is really starting to train yourself to be the driver of your own bus, and that's cool.
What made you choose mindfulness meditation out of the meditation techniques?
I don't know. It made sense to me. I've tried lots. I spent lots of years doing the hippie thing, you know, barefoot, dreadlocked, and cruising around India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and China and Tibet and Thailand and Indo, and, you know, a lot, mainly in Asia, but other parts of the world as well. And so I tried all sorts of different meditations. And I don't know, why did I choose mindfulness? It would have just been books that I'd read, conferences that I went to. There was a keynote speaker at the Global Mindful Leader Forum that I went to, and he struck a chord with me. I was like, oh, wow, I get what you're saying. It makes sense. And he was talking about mindfulness meditation. Also, mindfulness has become pretty trendy over the last however long.
It's a great trend. I'm so glad it's a trend that's developing. It's
amazing. Yeah, me too. Me too. And one of the meditation app that I use the most is called Waking Up by Sam Harris.
Sam Harris, yeah. And I haven't used it. I keep hearing about it. I keep hearing about it a lot.
It's a great app. It's a really good app. There's tons of resource on there. He comes from a neuroscientist background, so he has a very pragmatic approach to something that other people look at through the lens of a very kind of spiritual, esoteric, woo-woo, quote-unquote, lens, whereas his is very pragmatic. It's very experiential and easy to grasp and access. So I just find his way of explaining mindfulness and guiding meditations works for me.
Nice. What got you out of the hippie era? Or are you still in there deep down?
I reckon I'm still a hippie at heart. Although I never identified as a hippie, even when I was hanging out with hippies, I had an aversion to the whole hippie movement and I was a latecomer into it.
But you had dreadies.
I had dreads, yeah. I was more kind of, I came at it from a bit more of a harsh anti-establishment direction. So I really rebelled against, I didn't want to be my dad. As much as I loved him, I also did not want to be him. And that was that father-son relationship was very archetypical and common for me, was what propelled me into being really alternative and quite vocally and demonstrably anti-establishment, you know. So through my early, right through my 20s, quite punk, cyberpunk, raves, piercings, drugs, living in a squat in London, like just going, fuck the system, you know, scorning at the people who were in the morning traffic in their suits and ties going, ha, 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 I'll never be like you. Fuck the system.
Were you ever?
Then I went and later on did a chapter. I did a chapter in my 30s when I became a dad and I was like, fuck, I've got to feed these kids. What am I going to do?
Get a job.
And I got a job and I ended up in corporate leadership in a multinational company, which also led to my midlife crisis/awakening proper. And that led to that, because through those 8 years of being in a shirt and tie, and all my friends were going, oh my God, what are you doing? And I'm like, I've got a job, I've got kids to feed. And then that, I lost my way and I did lose my way from my values and I lost my way and life got pretty inwardly dismal. On the outside, I was like an Instagram feed. I had the, you know, beautiful wife and the two young kids and we built a house and I had a job. And the outside was like an Insta feed. The inside was like shit getting worse and worse and going really, really wrong. So I'm really glad I had that midlife awakening and lost everything and had to start all over again, because I got the opportunity to come back to my values and what really matters to me, you know.
How do you think you stay? This is an interesting topic because I've worked for myself for pretty much the better part of 10 years. And very recently in the last 12 months, I've just made a number of key financial and business decisions that have effectively blown up the business in the negative. And I'm kind of at this point where I'm like, all right, well, there goes my buffer. I've funneled a vast majority of what I had back into the business to try and like pay out people for the mistakes I've made.
Yeah.
And I am looking at this and going, all right, well, maybe it's time to pack it up and get a job and do some normal things. So my question to you, and this is a selfish question, but I'm sure there's listeners out there with this question: how do you stay in corporate without losing your soul?
I don't know if I'm the best person to ask, because I couldn't, because I got spat out. That's when I found my soul.
Based on what you learned from getting spat out, what could you have done differently to stay there?
Get really clear on your core values, right? What are your personal core values? And find a way to be true to them on a day-to-day basis. That's part one of the answer. Part two of the answer, create some sense of meaning or purpose to your work, right? Something. And you get to make it up. It's not preordained, I don't believe. You just get to make it up. But what do you give a shit about? What is something that you give a shit about, and how do you feel like you can make some sort of difference to that end? And find a way to have that as a part of what you do in the corporate world. It's possible, right? And then the third thing is, get really clear on the little what's. What do I do specifically? What parts of my job light me up? What are the little bits? I mean, I know there's a whole bunch of shit I have to do that's not really that fun. I just have to do it. That's fine. Do it. But what are the little bits where you lose track of time? What are the little bits where you wake up in the morning and you go, oh, cool, today I get to do that bit that I love, right? Those bits where you are in flow state. Get really clear on what they are and make your role, and if you have to lead up the line and get your leader to listen to you around, hey, I love doing this shit and I'm really good at it. If anyone else doesn't want to do these bits, I'll do it. I'll put my hand up for sure. Make sure you get those little bits pretty regularly in your role and you'll be motivated because you love what you do to a certain degree. So they're my three tips.
Okay, cool. And do you think in your situation you could have, if you'd taken that advice, it would have worked for you?
My boss was even trying to give me bits of those advice. You know, and I wasn't in a state where I was ready to listen or understand. You know, yeah. I was still because I still had this racket going on unbeknownst to myself. It was a subconscious racket. But I had this subconscious belief that I wasn't good enough, right? Whatever that means.
And where do you think that came from?
Well, it came from being – largely came from being human.
So you think because as humans we're not good enough?
Humans have a belief. So when humans have these three – when we're little, tiny people, when we're young, we have these three core fears. What if I'm not enough? And they're survival fears. They're built into us, right? What if I'm not enough, i.e. what if I'm not enough for my mum and dad? Because if my mum and dad don't care about me enough and just were to leave me, I'd die. Right. So I need to, what if I'm not enough for mum and dad, which then can become a what if I'm not enough in general. And then for some of us, a lot of us actually, I've found out since doing the work I do over the last 10 years, but for a lot of us, it becomes a subconscious belief, I'm not enough. Right. That's what leads to imposter syndrome, you know, when someone's like, oh, someone's going to come and knock on the door and say, all of this success you've created, you're not worthy. We've found you out. Goodbye. That's imposter syndrome. What if I'm not good enough for this? And it's also self-sabotage, which is where it came in for me. So if you believe that you're not good enough, then when you start to get closer to success, guess what you do? You sabotage it because you don't believe you deserve it. So you fuck it all up, right? Which is what was happening with me. So that is one of those three fears as a kid. What if I'm not enough? The other one is what if I'm not connected? Like what if I'm isolated?
Wow.
So the second fear, what if I'm not connected, right? What if I'm isolated? And humans need to be connected. We only survive in community. And if you're an introvert, that's just a few people. If you're an extrovert, it's as many people as possible. But nonetheless, we have a need to be connected. So there's a fear of that as a kid being isolated. And then there's also the fear of not being loved. Right, and they all kind of tie into each other. So that's where the fears come from. They're just human. That wasn't just me. I mean, when I talk about this with people, they're all like, "Oh my god, yeah." So for me, it developed into I'm not enough, and I didn't even realize. And it was also to do with my dad. And there was one time when I was 6 years old, and he lost his temper with me, and it got physical, and he threw me around and hit me, and yada yada, and scared the shit out of me. And I didn't know at the time. But now I look back and go, I reckon that was one of those things that happened where I made it mean something, which is what we do. We make shit mean stuff. And I made it mean that I wasn't good enough for him, because if I was good enough for him, he wouldn't have hurt me. Right? Mm. So that makes sense that a six-year-old would kind of go, oh, I'm not good enough for my dad. He hates me or he hurts me or whatever. So that you know, set me off down on the life of having a background belief that I wasn't good enough. And if you had have asked me in my 20s, do you believe you're good enough? I would have gone, yeah, man, I'm awesome. But it was all bravado. It was all an exterior, a veneer, you know. And it wasn't until through my 30s and through a marriage that got further and further south, and in the end too far south to save. It wasn't until then and a remarkable experience in a North American Indian sweat lodge sitting on Australian indigenous land in a ritual where I had an out-of-body experience and realized, and then went home and had this completely lucid, cathartic dream about a serpent inside me. And that's when I woke up the next morning and went, holy shit, I've got this belief that I'm not good enough. You know, and that was the start. That was the catalyst for the midlife crisis slash awakening. And then I lost my job and lost my marriage and lost my house and lost everything except my two sons, and started all over again with my boys as a single dad and started doing the work on myself, which was rewiring. And thank fuck for neuroplasticity. Otherwise, I would have been screwed. But we can change our beliefs, which is great. So I rewired my beliefs and went to work. And it took me a while and repetition and consistency and tenacity to rewire my belief, and especially that fundamental one, that actually I am enough. I am good enough and I deserve any success that I create and any happiness and joy in the relationships and the people that I love. I do deserve it. We all do. You know. So I rewired my beliefs and my life changed, which was a relief.
And where are you at now, like financially, like business-wise, family-wise, like what's it look like now?
So lucky, man. I'm so lucky. And most importantly, my relationships are beautiful. My relationship with my current partner, we've been together for 8 years. And people used to say to us when we were at the start, people are going, oh, you're just falling in love. It's the honeymoon period. It'll finish. It'll become just like, you know, bland. And we both knew it wouldn't, and it hasn't. It just continues to become more conscious and more loving and more divine.
What do you think
it is? It's really beautiful. So there's that. And my relationship with the other really important people in my lives, so my kids and mom and my siblings and, you know, close friends and extended family members, it's beautiful. So the most important part to me is those relationships. That's wonderful. And then the rest of it's, it's just so nice to be where I'm at now, because I've worked my ass off to get here. And when I first started my own coaching practice 10 years ago, I had to sell my house to do it because I couldn't afford my house and I was in debt and it was getting worse, but I was so determined. So I sold up and started renting at the ripe old age of 42 and with nothing, no belongings or anything, surfboard and a guitar was it. And debt, I had $100,000 of debt that I walked away from the marriage with. And over the last 10 years, the debt's gone. We live in paradise. I've got time, which is the most precious resource, because I earn really good money doing the work that I do. I'm lucky enough that my bread and butter work, which is the leadership stuff and the culture stuff, comes to me. I don't have to go looking for it because I've got a really good reputation. And, so there's plenty of work. I earn really, really good money. The kids have got a great life. We love where we live on a farm in Bellbray with ocean views, and that's beautiful. I get to travel the world running retreats in the Himalaya and in Bali, and that's awesome. I've just signed a book deal in the States, like I mentioned to you before, and that's fucking cool. And there's the TEDx talk, and there's the online programs that I've designed, and I'm excited about the future. There's more to come, and my partner and I are in business together. We run retreats together, and we've built studios down here in Torquay. It's called Village Wellness Torquay, and there's these wellness studios that we've built, and that's exciting. And there's still plenty of time to surf and go away on holidays and camp and hike and trek and play my guitar. And so I'm very lucky, man. I feel very, very lucky.
And it all started when you lost your job and you lost the plot and you lost your marriage and...
Yeah. It got really bad, you know, before I lost everything. It got really shit for me. The most vulnerable part, which I'm okay to share now, but for years and years and years and years, I wouldn't tell anybody about this. I was so ashamed. And the weight of the shame and the embarrassment and the disappointment in myself and the self-loathing and the weight of it all was almost too much. And for me, all of my anxieties manifested in one specific part of my life, which was sexual intimacy. And it manifested into sexual anxiety. And what that looked like for me was either impotency or premature ejaculation, but panic attacks. So that it got to the point trying to have sex. It got to the point where I couldn't even have sex because I would be overwhelmed with panic and anxiety. It was horrible. And I was so ashamed I couldn't tell anyone. So it was this deep, dark torture that me and my then wife were going through. And she was obviously so embarrassed about it as well. I mean, she may have told people, women, generally speaking, women find it easier to talk about harder stuff than men do. Men just kind of either put it head in the sand or put it to the side or compartmentalize it and get on with life and get shit done, right? So it got really bad. And then also financially, it got really bad as well. You know, it got to the point where I was in overwhelm and I was ignoring my bills. And I had this pile of bills because I had all these debts and they were getting bigger and bigger, exponentially getting bigger, right? Several credit cards and mortgages and all this kind of stuff. And I'd lost my job, right? So I was earning really good money before I lost my job. And then I lost my job and I wasn't earning anything anymore. And I went to working with a local cleaner, cleaning toilets and houses and stuff for, I don't know, $20 an hour. And I'd been earning a lot more than that. So it was pretty hectic, man. And I remember one of my breaking points was my mum came around to see me, and I was in my early 40s, right? Apparently, if you believed the Instagram feed, not that I was on Insta at the time, but if you believed what I was portraying out to the outside world, I had all my shit together. But inside I was crumbling, man. And mum came round and I just burst into tears. And she said, "How are you?" And I just burst into tears and I lost my shit, her little meltdown. And I showed her this big, massive pile of bills. And I had no money in the bank. And I had these kids that I was trying to feed. And mum sat there with me and we opened every bill one by one. We prioritized them. We worked it out. And she said, "I'm going to lend you a chunk of money to pay these bills." So she lent me a chunk of money and I sorted that out. And then I looked at her and I said, "I'm going to have to sell my house." And this was the house that I'd just built. Like me and my then wife had just built this house, like your dream house kind of thing. I said, "I'm going to have to sell the house." And so I did. So I sold the house and still walked away with you know, round figures, 100K of debt. And that was 10 years ago. So, and then from then till now has just been this beautiful journey, hard at the start, really hard, but beautiful journey of self-reparation, right? Repairing my relationship with myself, and doing all the work, all the personal development work I needed to do. And at the same time, getting out there and showing up and taking action and building a coaching business. And thankfully I've been successful in that. And I turn over really good money now.
Brilliant. You mentioned briefly on the relationship side of things that your relationship is strong and conscious. How have you maintained that?
Because we're conscious. We're conscious of,
you think that's why?
Being conscious. Like we set it up at the start. We you know, it was just beautiful timing, us, Talia and I, to find each other when we did, because we'd both come to similar points in our lives with similar pasts. And also similar hopes and dreams for what a relationship could be like moving forward. And when we communicate, one of the foundations to this relationship being what it is that we communicate a lot about everything. And we also allow each other the space to be who each other is, you know, with very little judgment and lots of open-mindedness. So when we first got together, we said, "Hey, for this relationship to have any chance of being different than what we've experienced in the past, what would need to happen for you? What goes on in a relationship that you wish you had in your past marriage?" We both asked each other, and we had things in common. Like, we both were in relationships where we felt like we were walking on eggshells. You know, you're always worried about saying the wrong thing because the other person would get upset and it could become, it was volatile, and we didn't want that. So, because what happens when you walk on eggshells for long enough and you don't want to upset the other person because you want it to be harmonious, you end up not saying things, and then you end up keeping things to yourself, and then there becomes this kind of dishonesty to a certain degree, because you're not just being honest about how you're feeling about anything, right? Mm. And that's a horrible way to live. So we were determined to not have that.
I understand the feeling.
You know that feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And it comes from an innocent place. You just don't want to upset the other person, or you don't want to create a tense environment, so you just keep it to yourself. And, you know, but it was crazy. Like, I got to the point where in my past relationship, in my marriage, I got to the point where if I'd had an awesome day, like a ripper of a day. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm feeling so good. You know, I had some wins and I'd be driving home playing some happy music and I'm just going, oh my God, what a day, right? I'd get home and then tone it all down and then walk in the door and come in neutral. Because if I came in all happy, like, whoa, I've had a win, and she said, you know, how was your day? And I go, awesome, this happened. It was amazing and amazing. What I would get back would be, oh, well, it's fine for you. Yeah, good on you. I'm stuck at home with the kids. And then, you know, it's all good for you to be all happy and da-da-da out in the world. Look at me, blah, blah. It was always brought back to how unhappy she was. And I didn't want that. So I'd just come in and go, oh, it was okay. How's your day?
Mm.
You know, so I became an island from her. So anyway, in this current relationship, we said, let's always tell each other our immediate truth. IT, we call it IT. Another tenement or principle that we came up with was we promised each other, I promise to love you just as you are with all your bits and bobs, right?
Mm.
Not the potential of you. I'm not going to sit here hoping that if you just fixed that one bit of you, then you would be awesome. No, no, no. I'm going to love you. I promise to love you just as you are. And because that was something that we built at the start and we promised each other to live by, now it's become, you know, not a reflex. It's become, I guess it neurologically it is a kind of reflex. If Talia does something or says something or doesn't do something or doesn't say something, if there's something that Talia does or doesn't do, and I get triggered by it, and I go, ah, pretty quickly, I'm talking within 5 seconds, I'm going, hey, Jem, you've promised to love her just as she is. And I look at her and I go, do you know what? In my mind, I say to myself, oh my God, I love you just as you are with all your stuff, right? And then I'm thinking, so I got triggered. So what's my stuff? What's my opportunity here to let go of something traumatic or not, or something from the past that I just got triggered on, right? So anyway, and we read the same, we're into the same books, we're into the same personal development, we go to the same workshops together, we study tantra together, we're on this journey together. So that's it. That doesn't mean we always agree on everything, man. It's not like we're just going, oh yes baby, whatever you reckon. No, if I disagree, I'll say, and if she disagrees, she'll say, but we just disagree with each other respectfully. You know, we've never, ever been abusive to each other. Not once in 8 years have we ever gone, you fucking blah, 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 right? Because it's unnecessary.
It makes a good point that I'd like to probably expand on here, which was you mentioned disagreeing respectfully. So, I mean, given that you're in the importance of communication, how do you go about disagreeing respectfully?
I think step one is to, first of all, get curious and seek to understand.
Before being understood.
Being understood, But if someone says something contentious, if someone says something and my initial reaction to that is I completely disagree with that, if it's not a conversation that we've already had ad nauseum and we're just a broken record in that moment and we both know that we've agreed to disagree on this already, so why the fuck are we still talking about it, right? If it's not that, if it's a new person or a new conversation or a new idea that I've immediately put the walls up to, then my conscious work is to go, hang on a second, Jem, hang on, mate. Where are they actually coming from? This person in front of me right now, where are they coming from? How did they come to this? I want to know. I am going to be curious and I'm going to seek to understand where you're coming from, right? Then I'll make a much more informed decision about whether I agree with you or not. And if I don't agree with you, that's fine too. But, you know, if everyone you ever came across only ever said anything that you already believe and feel and it didn't challenge your way of thinking at all, you're not going to grow ever. You're not ever going to expand your horizons mentally. It's when someone sits in front of you and says, no, actually, I reckon this, that's the opportunity. You go, hey, shit, a contentious idea. What are you? Tell me more. Yeah. How did you come to think about that? What led you to that? You know, because then you're going, actually, do you know what? I'm going to modify my way of thinking about this potentially or not, or I'm going to confirmation bias and double down on my belief or whatever you do. But to disagree respectfully means to allow the other person their point of view, right? They're entitled to their point of view as much as you're entitled to yours.
What if, so let me think about this for a second. So using, trying to tap into my experiences as an example, like I understand this, the element of curiosity to build connection, to get to the root of, you know, different opinions on topics. I've noticed a certain type of personality that I have challenges with, which are, and I'm sure, you know, if I'm having the challenge, I'm sure plenty of other people have the same challenge. So the type that feels like they haven't been, it's like there's like a rant that begins, that never ends, and you can't actually break into any of the topics because it's, there's 100 topics in one scenario. So what would you recommend for somebody who is trying to lead from the place of understanding, but then gets overwhelmed with 100 different points of problems and reasons why versus, you know, one problem, one solution, one problem. Like I know they're very different approaches to the world, but I hope that makes sense.
Well, first, let's just take a step back first. It depends on what the purpose of the communication is. You know, there's a million different reasons why any piece of communication or conversation could be happening. And to understand what is the purpose of this communication right now, if your only reason for engaging in this conversation with this person is to try and convince them of a different way of thinking, well, good luck with that. If it's someone socially and they're just a million miles an hour bombarding you with a million different things and you're feeling overwhelmed, the overwhelm is coming from your intention to try and speak to all of those things, but there's too many of them and you're starting to get overwhelmed because it's like, I can't speak to that and that and that. But if you drop that, if you drop that intention of having to respond to everything and speak to everything, if you made the purpose of that communication in that moment was just for them to feel emotionally, psychologically, energetically heard, then all you need to do is just sit and be present and just let them go and just look at them and listen and be present and drop the internal, oh, fuck, shit, I've got to respond to all of this or defend my ideas on this or I've got to reply to that. And no, but I've got something to say about that point. But now you've moved on to another point and you're getting over it. No, just go, hang on a second. Right now, this person has got verbal diarrhea and they are very passionately ranting about a million things. They need to get it off their chest. I'm just going to sit here, hold space for them and let them get it all off their chest. And when they finally run out of wind or things to say, which they will eventually, when they finally run out of things to say, just let the silence do the heavy lifting. Just sit there. Don't respond. Just sit there and be present with them. And let the silence do the lifting, you know. And then if they say, well, what do you reckon? You go, to which part? What's your question? Do you have a question for me?
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes we get caught up in having to defend a point of view. When you realize you've got nothing to defend or you don't need to defend anything, then it just becomes a whole lot easier, you know. But the context might be different. You might be in business with someone, just say your past business partner, right? And the two of you need to agree on a business decision. And you are sure that you know that your way of doing it is going to get the better result, right? And you don't want to let go of that because you care about the health of the business. And your business partner's talking a million miles an hour and they're a more dominant character and they're talking over you and they're not giving you any space, right? But you do need to get your point across and you do need to try and convince them of the way that you want it to go because you care about the life of the business and you might know something, right? So again, let them rant, let them rant, let them rant, let them rant. When they've finished, now this is very strategic and technical, but it works. When they've finished, just pick some of the key things they said and repeat back to them and say, hey, what I've heard you say is this, 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 and this, and this. Just repeat back exactly the words they said in some key points And they go, oh, good. So you heard me. And you go, yeah. Now, for these reasons, I still disagree. And I'm adamant that we're taking this course of action right now. And if you'd like, I can explain why.
I'm actually writing notes right now. It's great.
Hey, I tell you what, the person who stays the calmest in any negotiation is going to win. When I say win, I mean get it done the way they want it done. The person who stays the calmest and the most centered, the person who says less in negotiation. But also,
there's a fine line.
Yeah, go on.
No, you go on.
I was just going to say that, you know, when you are calm, centered, and present, which means letting go of your outcome in that moment, you're not going to forget it. You're not going to forget what you give a shit so much about. You're not going to forget it, but just let it car park it for a sec. Just become calm, centered, and present, and less is more. And, you'll always get a better outcome.
On the negotiation front and that sort of stuff, I'm just thinking about this a bit more now. And I think the challenge that I've had in the past is I've had people say to me that you got to be willing to walk away from a deal at any moment. Like, it's okay to walk away. And I've noticed that that's where I get really stuck. Like, I have to figure this out because there's minimal scenario where I'm going to walk away. And it's funny, it ties into my relationships as well. So I just thought about this and I'm like, wow, they're the same thing. So I'll sit in relationships where I know it's not right, but the idea of walking away, I want to fight for it. And it's to the point of like destruction, internal destruction. So it's an interesting point, like how your personal relationships and how your business relationships are. They're much the same, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're the common denominator, and it's all about relationships. And if you practice letting go, you know, letting go of the way you think things should be, or letting go of the way the relationship has been up until this point, letting go doesn't mean necessarily that the relationship won't continue. Letting go means that if it does continue, it's got more opportunity to renew, to evolve and change and grow and morph, which is the nature of all things. All things are in a state of flux and change. And when we hold on to something and try and keep it the way it is, this doesn't work and it becomes dysfunctional. You end up losing it. You know, that old adage, the tighter you grip onto it, it slips through your fingers and then you lose it. But if you loosen your grip a little bit and let it go and just, you know, metaphorically hold your hands open so that you can hold the space without grabbing onto it, I think it works better.
Yeah, definitely. And I think to tie this all together, a technique to actually specifically develop that skill is through meditation.
Yeah, that's one of them for sure. Yep. And also creating a habit. So the practice of getting better at being open-minded, if you create a habit, so for example, have a little sticky note next to where you keep your phone and it says whatever triggers you to remember to be open-minded, say open your mind. And when you're scrolling through your feed on your phone, if you see something, whenever you see a piece of news, whether it's on your phone or on the TV or whatever, when you see a piece of news, notice your immediate opinion, because you'll have one. You'll have an immediate opinion. Boom. Oh, that's fucked. That shouldn't matter. Just notice it and go, huh. Maybe even have a notepad and a piece of pen. I'm going to practice some open-mindedness now. Write down your immediate reflex opinion on it and then sit there for a moment in silence. Turn your phone off now. Stop scrolling. Stop. Sit. And examine your point of view and ask yourself, perhaps, if I didn't have that point of view, what other point of views might be possible? And just sit there and spend 2 minutes in contemplation of alternative perspectives. Now, that's an actual practice that you can actually physically do. If you made a practice of that once a day, you are firing the corresponding neurons across the synapses that are required for you to do that, where you turn your phone off, sit there and contemplate alternative perspectives for 2 minutes, right? If you do that every day, I guarantee you over the course of a year, you will start to create a habit of open-mindedness. You'll start to catch yourself and go, oh shit, I was really immediately opinionated about that. I wonder what other perspectives are possible. And I, you know, that, so that's a very pragmatic application of, you know, of developing our ability to be open-minded.
You are speaking about a few things that I was going to touch on, and they're all kind of coming together now. Right at the beginning, before we even started the podcast, you said this medium of long-form conversation is really important. What makes you say that?
Well, for different reasons that are all part of the same occurrence, right? So from an individual perspective, when we converse, we are talking through our ideas and then we're having them mirrored back to us, or we're hearing different take on that same idea. So there's, first of all, there's the practice of communicating your thoughts, which is good for you because it helps you have clarity around what do you actually think. So talking about what you think and feel is important. But talking about what you think and feel in a conversation with someone else who also is sharing what they think and feel, where there'll be things that you agree on and see similarly, or there'll be things that you disagree on or see differently. So it's a personal development. It's good for personal development. It's also good because it continues the conversation. It continues the evolution of ideas and conversation. If I didn't sit down and have this conversation with you, I wouldn't have been opened up to the way that you see things in a certain way, which slightly changes the way I experience things as well, right? So there's an evolution growth component to it. Then there's the absolute physiological benefits of it, because we're connecting and that is good for us and it feels good and it's nice and we feel connected and we feel hopeful and we feel optimistic and we feel like, wow, there's other good people out there. It's not all doom and gloom, right? So that's good. That's nice. And then the fact that we're recording this conversation and we're going to share it. So there's the potential for other people to hear it and go, oh yeah, right, I didn't think of it like that. So maybe I can use that or whatever. So there's that potential. And then on a metaphysical, quantum physical level, which I can't prove, and my intuition on this might be wrong, I don't know, but I feel like in some potentially woo-woo way, but also for me coming from a science background in a very quantum physical way, we are all connected. We're all part of the same living, breathing, massive system, greater system. And that when you and I put these ideas on vibration, we are a butterfly effect. We are actually physically affecting space around us, within us and around us, of which we're all a part. And that we're doing a tiny, tiny, tiny little part of helping humanity by talking about things that should be spoken about.
I love that. And I agree with the metaphysical stuff. I mean, there's a lot in our world that we don't understand. And again, it ties back to meditation partially and just letting go and being flexible and understanding, being flexible and being curious, all of these, many of these tenets that you live by. On the flexibility front as well, how can flexibility in your thought process improve your ability to communicate and connect? And what are some specific techniques of being flexible?
When you're flexible, you can be more responsive. You know, if I wasn't flexible or adaptable in my thinking, I mean, and we all are, but some more so than others, and some are more determined to be inflexible. You know, this is my point of view. This is my rhetoric, i.e., these are the words I use to communicate my point of view, and I'm going to say it regardless of what you ask me or say or whatever. I'm going to get my point across. And that just doesn't make for a great conversation.
It's that goes back to point one, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Listen, right? listen to let the rant let the rant end, let the silence do the heavy lifting, reiterate what you said, and then ask specific questions.
You know, and it's, then the conversation has no flow. There's no journey. There's just this stuck path. And inevitably, the unexpected and the unpredictable will happen. That's just life, right? When does anything ever go exactly to plan? Think about the last time you had a meticulous plan on something. Did it go exactly to plan? No, I don't think it ever does. And so if you're not flexible, you just kind of get stuck and banging your head against a brick wall. So the adaptability, flexibility part, which also leads into helps our resilience, let alone helping a conversation flow in whatever direction it's going to go in. Yeah, look, I think it's really important, and it's a self-awareness piece. So you're in a conversation, someone said something, you want to respond to what they've just said, but they keep talking and you're going, oh, I'm going to remember. And you're, so remember. Now you're not listening. You're just remembering and waiting for a gap where you can jump in and say to that thing that they said 5 minutes ago, you know, like, yeah, sure, you had something to say to that, but they've moved on. Move on with them. See where it goes. And at some point you'll have something to say. Don't worry about it. If you don't, that's cool too, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. I'm going to give this a go with my mum and I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm conscious of your time. I'd love to just kind of rapid fire some things with you, and maybe we can see where those go and call it.
Sure.
After that, are you ready?
Yeah, man.
I mean, maybe they don't even have to be that rapid fire. So if there's a really good story behind it, all good. What's the kindest thing somebody's ever done for you?
Oh, there's been so many kind things. The kindest thing I've been a part of, so it wasn't exactly for me, but I was the conduit for it. I'd had this idea with this entrepreneur, this wealthy guy, to build a school in the village that is my second home in the Himalaya in India with my Himalayan family there. And I had this idea to build this internet school, and this guy was going to fund it. And he ended up turning out to be a cocaine addict and was all talk and never came through with the money. And me and my Indian brother had started putting all the logistics together. You know, we'd priced everything up. We had a building that we were going to buy and, you know, da da da. And I had to call him and say, man, I'm so sorry. The money's fallen through. It's not happening. And he was like, oh. And then a few weeks later, another person that I know who's a wealthy business person rang me up out of the blue and said, hey, Jem, can you ask around for me? I've got to a stage in my business where I want to do some philanthropic work. I want to invest some money. Can you look around for a worthy cause? And I said, dude, I don't need to look around. I've got it sitting right here. It's all ready to go. It's the school. We're going to build this school. It's an internet cafe. We've got everything ready to go, blah, blah, blah. It's just the money fell out. And he goes, how much money do you need? And I said, I only need 10 grand. He goes, yep, cool, I'll do it. And so he gave us the 10 grand and we built this school and we had enough money to pay teachers a wage for a year and everything. And him and his daughter flew over there and got to cut the ribbon on the school and open a new school in this village, which was beautiful for him and his daughter. And that was just so kind. That was, I think, one of the kindest things, yeah.
What's your thoughts on giving back and being philanthropic in your life and how important that is to the evolution of humanity?
Yeah. Giving and receiving are part of the same thing. When you get that, when you get that, you know, you need to be able to give and receive as fluidly both ways and appropriately, obviously. I love giving, you know, generosity. I actually have to be careful I don't give too much to the detriment of being able to feed the kids. One of my big drivers to continue to grow business-wise and to create wealth, actually. I want to create more money than I need purely because I want to give it away. So, I'm excited about it.
Mm. Well, I mean, the Warren Buffett thing, he's just playing a game at this point and he's dedicated to giving 99% of everything he earns to charity.
Yeah.
Just some huge amount, which is a big number. So, yeah, I like that. I like that idea. I like the idea of, you know, playing the game well, getting to a really successful point in your life, and then maybe giving your kids just enough to give them like a little kickstart and then giving the rest away.
Yeah.
What's your ideal morning and evening routine look like?
I touched on this with you earlier. I'm not sure if it was before we pressed record or not, but my morning routine is the first thing I do is wake up and I use AG1. Athletic Greens. Yeah, wake up. Good start. Yeah. I get up an hour before I need to, in terms of need to being getting ready to go to work.
We have to bleep AG1 out because they'll need to pay for that.
yeah. No, they'd love, no, I'm sure they'd love me mentioning them. So I have my supplement, my greens supplement is the first thing I do. And if, depending on the time of year, if it's summer, sunlight to the eyes, not looking directly at the sun, but, you know, thank you, blah, 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 for that. So sunlight to the eyes, then 20 minutes meditation, mindfulness meditation, 20 minutes of exercise. And then in my shower, the last 60 seconds of the shower, which is easy to do in summer and more difficult in winter, is full blast cold. So full blast cold water, dopamine levels peak. And then for 5 minutes.
Is it 60 seconds?
So I do 60 seconds of cold.
Is there a reason specifically?
Yeah, because you need to do 30 to 60 seconds for the dopamine levels to get to a point where they hang around for 2 to 3 hours afterwards. Some people do longer. Gotcha. I don't have an ice bath and I can't be bothered getting one or doing that. So, and the cold water works fine. So I just do the cold shower thing and then I'm doing my affirmations. So whatever they are for me at the moment, I am healthy, I am strong, I am disciplined, blah, blah, blah. These are my affirmations that I do. And I do them for about 5 minutes while I'm, you know, brushing my teeth and getting ready and getting dressed. So that's the morning. And then I'm off to work. My boys now are old enough that I'm not having to pack their school lunches anymore. One's heading off to uni next month and the other one's a tradie. He's doing full-time chippy apprenticeship and he's up before me and packs his lunch and he's off to the building site. So the days of ironing school uniforms and packing school lunches for me are done. So that's the morning routine. Throughout the day, I pause at least 3 times a day. I pause and I just mean in between doing two things. I stop, pause, take a breath. Notice what I can notice and then continue. Mm-hmm. And then evenings I also try to exercise, 5 times a week in terms of some cardio and some strength and blah, blah, blah. And then evenings are more chill for me. I love cooking, hanging out with my partner, cooking, making sure the kids are okay, a bit of telly, zone out to something, switch off, and then off to bed.
Cool. Cool. And if you could give advice to you 10 years ago, what advice would you give? I mean, I feel like this isn't a rapid fire question, but.
Yeah. You're enough. 10 years ago. No, I was onto that. 10 years ago, 42. I would have said, keep doing what you're doing. You're going to get there.
Okay. And if you could recommend only one book or a podcast or something for this person to do, and they can only do one thing for their whole lifetime and it has to be the most impactful thing possible, what would it be?
As in a book. So if it was one book to read, Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, Sapiens, that's a pretty awesome book.
That's the only book. The only power book you're allowed to read for the rest of your life. Yeah.
The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle, probably better for you. Yeah, The Power of Now. Yeah. Read that. One podcast, did you say?
Oh, that's it. It could be anything. It could be
a book or a podcast. But in terms of the thing, like one thing you can do for the rest of your life, contribute, find ways to contribute to the lives of others.
Brilliant. And because, you know, it's the energy exchange, it gives, it's the opposite side of receiving and giving. They're two of the same coin. And I think, you know, on a vibrational level, getting woo-woo, it brings out positive energy into the world that impacts other people. I've got this story that I say quite a lot. I mean, anyone that's listened to the podcast regularly has heard it a bunch of times. But in this context, in this conversation, I haven't said it. So I was, it's just a prime example of that. I was at Coachella a couple of years ago. We left, we were pretty dusty. My friend and I were at the gas station, you know, getting some petrol. His card wasn't working. He was getting quite frustrated. He was quite tired and all that. And this guy behind us saw us being frustrated and he turns around and goes, "Oh, I'll pay for your petrol. Just don't worry about it." It was only $20. And he paid for it, just like tapped his card. And then I said, "I'll give you money. We've got money. It's okay." He said, no, just pay it forward. And ever since then, for the last 2 years, I've once a week, I'll just do a nice little gesture for somebody, all because some random guy paid for $20 of petrol. And I'm like, I really like that. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So think about how many people.
I'll do that for the rest of my life.
Think about how many people already have benefited from acts of kindness because of one act of kindness. Mm. You know, I love that shit, man. Big time. I'm always looking for ways to do that. And it feels good.
Mm.
It feels good.
It doesn't have to be much.
No, it's the thought that counts. It's the gesture. It's the action, you know? Yeah, I love that. That's super cool.
It's a dollar amount that counts, is my saying.
What, you only gave me $20? Fuck you, asshole.
What do you mean? I mean, it was $20 USD, so that's like 30. It's
right. Yeah, okay.
No, I kid. Look, what is one change that somebody could make in their lives today that could begin to live a life similar to yours?
It's funny, live a life similar to mine. Keep moving into your version of of your best life. Yeah, for someone to keep moving into their version of their best life.
So you think you're living your best life right now?
Yeah, 100% right now. Yeah, definitely. 100% I'm living my best life right now. And does it look like what it's going to look like in 10 years? No. Does it look like what it did 10 years ago? No. But right now.
Goddamn no.
No. But I'm living my best life, 100%. Have I achieved everything that I hope to achieve in my whole life? No. But if it all ended today, would I die feeling good about my life? Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's a good place to be. And I think that's the sweet spot to be in.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, look, what could someone do? Someone could actually start dedicating some time to self-okayness, I call it. Self-okayness, just becoming okay with who you are right now and that you are, and understanding the reality and accepting the reality that you are exactly the version of yourself that you're supposed to be right now. You are 100% exactly who you're supposed to be right now. And how do I know that to be true? Well, because reality told me, because there you are, just the way you are. So apparently, this is who you're supposed to be right now. Now, is this the version of you that you're going to be in the future? No. Is it the version of you in the past? No. It's just who you are right now. So apparently, this is who you're meant to be right now. And that doesn't mean that you just kind of kick your boots off and go, well, fuck it, I'm not going to try and get any better. No, of course you're going to try and keep getting better. But right now, give yourself a pat on the back and go, hey, I made it to here. I made it to this moment. I made it to where I'm apparently supposed to be, which is right here, right now. And that practicing that acceptance piece, and it's a practice, it's a daily affirmation. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be right now. I'm exactly who I'm supposed to be right now. And I'm okay with that. Saying that out loud every day is a practice, but it's game changing because you start to stop wasting so much time doing regret and rue and disappointment and self-flagellation. I'm not good enough. And you start to just go, it's okay. Right now, what am I doing today? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. And how could somebody begin to work on being self-okay? Like what's one way to do that?
Well, affirmations is one way to do that. So saying out loud, I am exactly who I'm supposed to be right now. And that's enough, right? Saying it out loud. And the reason affirmations work, I used to think affirmations were woo-woo. I used to watch all my hippie mates sitting around doing mantras and affirmations, and I'm going, fuck, I'm what a crock of shit. You're all off with the fairies, right? When I was younger, that's what I used to think. Now, thankfully, there's enough literature and there's enough science behind it to satiate my need to know that it's actually working, apart from the experiential evidence that I've had over the years of doing it now. But neurologically, what's happening is that when you say something, the corresponding neurons have to fire in that sequence for you to say it. When neurons fire together repetitively over time, and especially when they fire in a brain state of higher dopamine levels, they quote unquote wire together thousands of times
so
faster.
So high dopamine environments wire your brain faster.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So that's why I'm doing my cold water. Dopamine levels go up, affirmations. And they're wiring together faster. And that's been proven.
What other times are there high dopamine periods?
In the anticipation of something. So, for example, pick something, a favorite exercise that you like to do. For me, going for a surf, right? So the surf's good and I'm driving to the surf and my dopamine starts to go up. It goes up in the anticipation of reward. And I'm standing in the car park, pulling my wetsuit on, looking down at the waves, going, oh, my God, right? That's when the dopamine's high. Or even like on a Sunday, your Sunday treat is that you go to your favorite ice cream place and get your favorite ice cream on a Sunday afternoon. And it's on the drive to getting the ice cream where the dopamine goes up. The minute you start tasting the ice cream, you've got sugar stuff going on. But as soon as you finish the ice cream, the dopamine's going, it's like, oh, okay, what next? I need a coffee now. Whatever.
Yeah.
Off to the next thing. So it's while you're driving to go and get said ice cream, that's when you're doing your affirmations. That's when the dopamine's high.
That's interesting. I have a bit of a battle when it comes to food and things like that. I try and diet and like be healthy, and then I have these time periods where I'll cave and go get an ice cream, for example. But it's interesting because now that you're saying this, the time period that I am on the way to doing that, my internal monologue is negative.
Oh, right.
Like it's a battle. So I wonder if that negative monologue is exacerbating the negative associations of the affirmations as I'm doing the things that I know aren't necessarily healthy or for my like best self or my healthier self.
Yeah. I wonder if
it makes it worse. You know,
yeah. I wonder if the negative self-talk about going to get an ice cream because you're punishing yourself already for doing something that you think is unhealthy for you. Well, for one, then the ice cream is doubly unhealthy for you if you go into it
mentally and physically. Yeah.
But so pick a different time, dude. Pick a time when you're going to do something that you have a perception that is good for you, and it's something you really enjoy. Pick a time like that. But you can do affirmations even when dopamine's not peaked. They still work. They just work a lot faster when the dopamine's high.
Cool. Something new to learn. I like it. And then just like a nice soft, like easy question to end it off. What do you think the meaning of life is?
The big kahuna. The big question. I have obviously thought, well, not obviously, I don't know if it's obvious. I have thought about this a lot. For me, at the very essence, at the very core of life is this innate drive for life to improve, to evolve itself. You know, when cells replicate, they try and replicate a slightly better version of themselves. That's evolution, right? That's how evolution happens. And so I believe from the human perspective, the meaning of life is to get better at being you and to evolve, to improve, and that means not just get better at being you on a selfish level, but to get better at being you as a contributing factor to the community, to life. How can I get better at being a positive influence to whatever degree to life? I think that's the meaning of life.
Brent.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jem Fuller. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Adam, thanks for having me, man. It's been really, really enjoyable.
I love it. Until next time.